probably measurement error more than anything. So. Okay.
Okay, thank you, Chair Shetterly and members of the committee. My name is Becky Shine. I am the Child Care Program Officer at the Enterprise Foundation. We are a national housing and development organization, and we work in particular with low and moderate income folks around developing affordable housing, job training, and child care needs. I was here testifying at the last hearing last week on the Stipendiate Care Tax Credit to encourage us to extend it a couple of years. There were some concerns about the level of its use, whether it was being used most effectively, and its impact. And I had mentioned after a question from Representative Beck that we are actually working on a pilot that would perhaps build very well on the Dependent Care Tax Credit and provide even a greater number of businesses with the incentive to invest in child care. With the support of Representative Patridge and the Child Care Commission, who will speak to you later, we are looking to postpone a work session on this piece and add an amendment that would add this pilot program with using $1 million of the $5.9 million projected for this pilot program. I want to just tell you a few things about why I think this pilot program is really exciting and why we've gotten the support we have. Previously, it was going to be a bill of its own, sponsored by Representatives Westland and Kefauri and Senator Brown. But it seems to be very appropriate to link it to this. And the reason is we have developed what I think is a very innovative mechanism for funding child care in the state of Oregon based on the success of the low-income housing tax credit. Low-income housing tax credit, as many of you might know, in this country has helped us build enormous number of affordable housing units, over 70,000 in the country. It's generated over $7 billion of private investment. And the way it's done it is by saying that businesses who invest in housing, whether or not they care about housing, get a financial return because they get in return for their cash, they get a greater number of tax credits in return. So right now, businesses are investing 80 cents in housing and getting back a dollar in tax credits. It has created new private investment in housing that we'd never seen before. It also has allowed us to keep rents for families at 30% of family income to make sure that we have quality and well-monitored housing. There has been interest nationally in saying whether we can model a tax credit for child care financing after the low-income housing tax credit success. And we have, in fact, designed what I think is a terrific model that would spur business investment. These are businesses who can care about child care or not care about child care. They have a financial incentive to invest in child care because they get more tax credits back in return than they put in cash. Over time, the amount they'll put in housing has risen because it's become a competitive process for businesses who want those tax credits and they're willing to invest more and more in housing, and we see the same thing happening in child care. The effect of this tax credit would be a pool of funds for the operations of home and center-based child care businesses. Our biggest issue is not simply developing new child care facilities like it was housing development. We really need greater revenue for child care businesses, home and center-based, because right now providers are earning an average of $12,000 a year. We also need to limit parent cost. Right now, low-income parents are paying up to 37% of their income on child care costs. It's outrageous. And we're looking, like in housing, to say providers who are eligible for these operating funds have to keep fees for their parents at 15% of family income. So it would reduce parent cost, it would increase provider revenue, and it would also ensure quality because there's a whole training and oversight component of the providers that are participating so that they would be high quality. With those funds, too, you'll find that providers will be able to earn livable wages and get the training that's necessary. The administrative costs for this would come out of the pool of funds that these tax credits would generate, so we're not requesting additional administrative funds. We are also working with the Child Care Division and the Department of Housing and Community Services on the administration of this. We're talking with them about how that would work. The Department of Housing knows how to fiscally administer tax credits. It would be an easy thing for them to do without new staff, new training, et cetera. So we think this is a really exciting pilot. You'll hear more from others, but I would like to suggest that for us to be able to prove in the next legislative session that this is an effective method, we would love to have the opportunity to move this pilot. So we hope that you will decide to allocate $1 million of this tax credit with the support of Representative Patridge and the Child Care Commission for this pilot. Thank you very much.
Okay. And so you are asking us to hold off action on this today until you get your amendments drafted and back in the dash threes or whatever they would be.
Yes, sir.
Otherwise, your amendments would work with the dash one and the, I'm sorry, I guess we just have the one, the dash one amendments. Your amendments would work with the dash one.
Absolutely.
Okay. Any questions for Becky?
Is this going to duplicate anything that's being done for ERCP? You know what that program is?
ERDC, the employment-related daycare.
Yeah.
No, in fact, it complements it very nicely. Employment-related daycare provides low-income working families with subsidy from the state, and those subsidies would still come with parents, but they would still only have to pay 15% of their income. Right now, even with employment-related daycare, folks are paying up to 20% of their income. So it would, this again would help that. They'd be getting the subsidy and keeping their costs down.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to see how that exactly, how they blend the two programs. And one of the problems we're fighting in AFS, in Adult Family Services, is we have dozens of programs for any of the same job, and they're overlapping. It's very confusing for the client, and there's probably a lot of administrative waste that way.
Right.
So I'd like to see how those two mesh together.
Absolutely. I should say the other piece of it is that employment-related daycare goes directly with the families that need it. This program would go in the shape of operating revenue to businesses, home and center-based businesses. So the family wouldn't have to go through undue, you know, another system to access this. It would simply be the providers would get the operating revenue, and for those parents using that provider, their fees would be limited to 15% of their income. That doesn't help clarify. Pardon me. We obviously also... Sorry.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Why don't she and I can do this conversation later time? We're taking up everybody's time. And
I would have to explain that further. Pardon me.
We'll get that later.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Beck.
Maybe I missed this. I was distracted. The sunset date is 2003 or 2002. I see someone. It says 2000, December 31st, 2003 in the bill. Have we talked about that, and do we want to extend that further? There's a reason we're only doing 2 years. We have a lot of programs that have longer sunsets than this.
Mine is 2004.
When I'm looking at the legislative revenue summary here, it says extends employers dependent care through December 31st, 2003.
Right, because it's going to be 2 years from now, so it should be 2003, as I understand.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, it extends the credit availability through the end of 2003 or before January 1, 2004.
Okay.
But it is interesting, Chairman, may I respond to that? Is it interesting that you asked that, because in the kinds of tax credits we're talking about with this pilot modeled after the low-income housing tax credit, they tend to have most effect and even greater private investment when they're extended to the period of 5 years. For instance, the Farm Workers Housing Tax Credit is a five-year credit, and it's able to, investors are willing to pay more and invest more into the subject if the tax credits last somewhat longer. So if you're, you know, interested in considering that, I think it's very beneficial for the investment pool.
I just raised that issue. Maybe they want to chat with you or other members of the committee, but
okay.
I'm just trying to, to the extent we can keep some appropriate people from coming back every 2 years, some tax credits may merit 4 or 6 year time frame, some should be 2 years, but this one seems like a longer duration makes some sense.
Well, thank you for the clarification on that date. We have in the bill it says prior to years prior to January 1, 2004, and in the measure summary it says through December 31, 2003.
Right.
So I guess
same.
Functionally the same thing.
Right.
Okay. Anything else?
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee.
Mark Overbeck.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mark Overbeck. I'm the interim executive officer with the Oregon Commission for Child Care. Your advisory body is the governor's advisory body also, committed to access to safe, quality, and affordable child care for all Oregon's families. As a commission, we believe, and frankly, I hope you tire of hearing this, that quality child care in Oregon really means a quality future for our state. And like the Enterprise Foundation, our goal also is to get more investment from the private sector into child care. We believe that business is a very important partner in the solutions that our state needs to have. Want to want to also offer our request that the work session be extended, that we have a chance to have the -3 amendments or the -2 amendments put forward and considered by the committee. We believe that the pilot effort put forward by the Enterprise Foundation is a promising innovation, deserves an opportunity. We don't want to jeopardize the current tax credit, and certainly to Representative Beck's question, we would be open to extending it to a 4 or 6 year shelf life rather than just a 2 year extension. We do have questions of the commission. We want to make sure that our taxpayer dollars, whether they're direct subsidy or foregone revenue, are used as wisely as possible, that the money goes to child care providers, that it goes directly into child care, that it not be cumbersome. We're satisfied through our discussions with the Enterprise Foundation that this really is a very promising innovation. Want to see it given an opportunity to work at the tune of $1 million.
All right, to the tune of $1 million.
As Ms. Shine offered, okay, to take $1 million out of the expected revenue to come in.
Okay. I guess I have a question then on the date. This came in at the request of the commission for the extension to December 31, 2003. How was that date arrived? Why the request for a two-year extension and not a longer extension?
Mr. Chair, 2 years ago it was our understanding that this committee took a look at all of the tax credits. We believed at the time that we requested Representative Patridge to introduce a bill that a two-year shelf life was a reasonable request.
Well, I guess there's something to be said for bringing you back every session and telling your story. There's an educational component to that, too, kind of like the cigarette incentive tax.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, if it would allow us to go and make our case on other issues regarding child care, we'd be happy to have the four-year discussion or a six-year discussion.
No, we'll leave that to you if you want to talk to Representative Patridge to extend that, as long as you're... Well, I'd be making further amendments. Ed, did you want to say something? Okay. Like you were poised. Anything else, Representative Witt?
On this issue of what's the appropriate sunset, I would just point out that every 2 years, of course, we have to balance the budget, and it's appropriate those times to look at credits as part of an overall effort to balance the budget. So there's another value to that, I think.
Okay. So, yeah, Representative Bates.
I'm going to go back to my original question. So I'm going to give you a question that I'd like to have you bring back to the work session. The employment-related daycare is, I believe, a program funded both by the federal and state monies.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bates, in the past it has been funded by both those funding sources.
And since we're not funding it fully, as far as I understand right now in the budget, and it's about a 40-60 split, if I'm correct. I may be wrong about that. I'll go back and check my figures. I mean, if you take money out of tax, as a tax credit out of the general fund, versus taking money in, from the other side and getting it leveraged with federal funds, I'm not sure that we're going the right direction here. So I'd like to see a physical impact of what's the best way to impact these families financially and get them lowered health costs for the care. And if we can get federal funds to do 60% of it, why would we go this other direction? So I like to look at that. You may have some other issues that are not covered by that, and that maybe some families that wouldn't be covered any other way. And so I'd like to hear both sides of that story.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, thank you for the question. We'd be happy to also have a conversation with you about the employment-related daycare program.
Thank you.
Could have moved the bill today. You got lots of questions. Okay, is there anything further for Mr. Overbeck? All right, anybody else wish to be heard on this? Do I understand that Representative Patridge might be coming down? Okay. In that case, I will, instead of closing, I'll just recess the work session on House Bill 2676 for the time being and open a work session on House Bill, I'm sorry, a public, that was a public hearing anyway, wasn't it? Okay, I'll recess the public hearing. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2161. Dick?
Good
If you would, please.
Nobody interested. Mr. Chair, 2161, Dickie Yates, for the record. This is a reforestation tax credit. The bills that came to you extends the sunset on the existing tax credit, and also has language on page 3, line 8, which further restricts the costs that are eligible for the reforestation tax credit for financial assistance or other incentive programs, which are just sort of, I think, intended to be included, but not specifically included in the language. You asked for an amendment to this bill, which would increase the amount of the credit from 30% to 50%, and that was before you last time you met with the dash one amendment. You should have those.
Okay, we do.
Mm-hmm. I have redone the revenue impact on the original form of the bill. The reason for that is that what I had estimated previously was credit certified by the Department of Forestry, and what we're really interested in is what's claimed against tax returns. So I've reduced this and reduced it to be consistent with the tax expenditure report issued by the Department of Revenue. So that's down to so that when the program is fully phased in, the extension in 2003-2005 is about $500,000 a year. And you also have a dash one revenue impact. Again, for the first 6 months, whether you increase the credit or not does not impact the amount of the credit just because of the delays that are involved in the program. In the 2001-2003 biennium, it increases the credit from about $292,000 to $540,000, and then when it's fully phased in, from $500,000 to about $1.3 million. Now, that's it's a little bit difficult to estimate how many people will apply, or more people will apply as a result of increasing the credit. The assumption I've made is that that will go to about 5,000 acres per year. And that's about a 50% increase over what they were doing prior to the sort of current stagnation of the program resulting from the nature of the markets and the nature of federal aid that's currently available for these activities.
We are in a public hearing. Nobody has signed up. Would anybody like to be heard, particularly on the dash one amendments? I think this was generated from conversation up here at the committee desk that if 30% was going to be an incentive, would 50% be a greater incentive to enter into these program into this program and result in reclamation, reforestation of even more acreage? And I guess I'd be curious if anybody wants to offer any testimony to that effect.
I would make one more comment.
Yes.
There is not a fiscal included in here. The fiscal impact estimated is minimal, even with the expansion of the program, and that's partially because it's sort of included in forestry's base budget,
okay.
And that's going to be whatever it is, whether it passes or not. You will have coming up probably next week another bill which is related to this bill, and that is the question of how you fund the administrative expense involved in this program, forestry's administrative expense, and the Department of Revenue's. And at that same bill, deals with the Western Oregon Small Tract Option Tax costs.
Question?
Yes, Representative Hass.
Mr. Chairman, why go to 50%? I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad idea, but what was the impetus for that?
Well, I think it was the more the conversation up here among committee members that if 30% was an incentive to bring X number of acres into this program, then would we get more people participating in greater acreage? At 50%, Christina, did we ask you, did we ask somebody that? And I think the answer was, yeah, probably. Yes, Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, I think I asked that question of the folks administratively who are administering this plan. And they indicated that they thought it would be a positive inducement to get more refurbishing, replanting, restoring land so that they're more productive. I don't think we were just asking the private sector folks on this. I think we specifically asked that question of the folks that have been administering the program in the Department of Forestry.
Wally, is this yours? Who should we ask? Why don't you come on forward, for both of you.
Chair Shetterly and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Wally Rutledge, and I'm the Director of Forestry Assistance with the Department of Forestry. Yes, that question did come up at the last hearing, and we answered in the positive, and since that time, I've had an opportunity to visit with several landowners and some of our people that administer the program, and they were all feeling very positive that this could have a very good impact on the numbers of people that might consider converting some of their underprotected land. Right now, the 30% is just not quite enough, but the 50% would push some of them over, and they would participate in the program.
Dick, I'm not quite sure I understood what you tried to tell us about the financial impact of this. You said that it was part of a the agricultural and forestry program, and that it wouldn't have a huge impact.
Well, there's a fiscal and a revenue impact.
Yeah.
Yeah, the revenue impact is done for this bill as it stands alone. The thing that's not addressed by this bill is that you are implicitly increasing the workload for forestry and the Department of Revenue in terms of the number of credits that get certified, the number of acres that have to be cost reviewed, certified, and the credits essentially authorized. And so there would be a fiscal impact in terms of agency expenditures, and that's all I'm saying is we've not addressed that in this bill. You will get an opportunity to address that in 2162.
Representative Witt.
Mr. Chairman, Dick, wasn't there some testimony that there had been an anticipated revenue impact from this program of $1.2 or $1.3 million? I mean, something sticks in my
There's
mind.
There's a statutory cap. There is a
that,
limit.
Maybe it was a statutory cap.
We are still under that limit. Do you know offhand what that statute is? It is about 1.3 or 1.4, as I recall.
If I may speak to that,
yes.
The limitation really addresses project costs.
Okay.
And so it's a little bit unclear what that allows in the way of credit certification in any particular year. But the cap is about $2.3 million, I think it is, in terms of the project cost. And actually, we need a little bit of data refinement to identify exactly what that cap is, and we're working on that at this point, but that's close. It's going to be close to that.
One of you want to help us on that? I have my question is, if you've got a cap of 2.3 in project costs and a 50% tax credit, how do you have a $1.3 million revenue impact?
You end up, well, you're going with $1.3 million, you're going to a 50% credit. But that occurs, there's,
you know, cumulative.
You get half of that initially, so that would be 25%. And then between the preliminary and the final certification, you may incur some other costs, which are called management costs, mm-hmm. to get that stand from planning to a free-to-grow status. And those are also eligible and would be eligible at 50%. When that stand is finally certified as free to grow, you get the second half of the preliminary project cost certified, 50% of that, plus whatever management costs you incurred in that interim. So there's a lag involved in there of 2 to 3 years between when the preliminary certification is issued and when they actually get the stand free to grow.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is the statutory cap is an annual cap, whereas here we're looking at a biennial revenue impact.
I appreciate that. Representative Pass.
The testimony from the Department of Forestry, though, says this is a good law and it's working well. At 30%, it doesn't make any requests for, well, it would be better if we could go to 50%. And I didn't hear anybody testify that this needs to be increased. And so I guess the little conundrum I'm facing is, why are we, who would get, I mean, the people who are doing this 50% obviously that we raise the credit to 50. And the question is, how many more people who are not doing it now would then do that? And I haven't really heard an answer, nor have I heard really a plea to raise the percentage to those people to do this.
Chair Shedley, Representative Hess, we have about 1.5 million acres of land that's currently underproductive. And we're currently getting about 2,500 to 3,000 acres per year. That is really not as well as we'd like to be doing. And in order to increase those acres out there, we really do need to increase the percent of tax credit. We didn't come with that in mind because we didn't really feel like that was appropriate. We were extremely happy to hear the committee having the same concerns that we had about we're not getting as much as we should be, and they're willing to at least discuss moving this to a 50%. And once that discussion is entered into, we fully support it and fully believe that there would be at least a 50% increase in the number of landowners and acres that would participate in the program.
Representative Bates?
Let me ask the question a different way. My sense last time was the program was actually underutilized and that full participation hadn't taken place. It hadn't reached your cap because it just wasn't enough for tax incentive for some people to work. Is that my correct understanding of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, that's correct. We do have a cap, and we have not come close to the cap at the 30%. By increasing to 50%, we hope that we could at least approach the cap and get a lot more participation.
I think that was the gist of your comment, Representative Witt, about increasing the credit to incentive to bring more people into the program.
When we had the public hearing.
Yeah, that's right.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I can ask Mr. Rutledge. Mr. Rutledge, is it your belief that should this going from 30 to 50% tax credit percentage, would that, in your opinion, lead to more productive forest lands in general, more output from those forest lands, greater economic value from those forest lands, and greater employment associated with those forest lands?
Chair Satterley, Representative Witt, yes, I would concur with that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, this is a follow-up to Representative Witt's question. I'm assuming that one of the reasons that we have this tax credit is because there is some financial gain to the state eventually with taxes on this timber. But do we have any numbers indicating that is so?
Chair Shedley, Representative Kafoury, we anticipate that on the average we could increase the production on each acre of land by about 20,000 board feet per acre per year. 20,000 board feet over rotation per acre. We could probably come up with some numbers that we could show what that would mean in terms of increased taxes to the state, increased number of jobs to the state, if you would like to see those numbers.
Mr. Chair, well, I think that might be one way to appease and answer Representative Hass's question about, I mean, if there's a logical reason to be doing the raise from 30% to 50%, other than just because we think it might incent more people to get involved with the program, if there were actually the numbers to show us that it would increase revenue at the end of the state.
Chair Shedley, Ray Craig, Assistant State Forester, if I might, Representative Kapoor. We can come up with the numbers, and that we certainly will do that. And there's certain associations that are made between production of timber on forest lands and jobs and tax revenues, and we've gone through that before. In the original, when this bill was set up in the late 1970s, it was definitely set up as one of a series of things that would help get underproducing forest lands producing again. That's always been the state's interest, and the state's. It's a financial interest as well as a jobs, interests, as well as, you know, the landowners themselves having the incentive to do this. There's also other issues with having producing forest lands as well in terms of habitat and other, you know, other things. So yeah, we can definitely come up with numbers for you and be glad to do that.
Well, I think it's a multifaceted benefit. Your testimony, I think it's, oh, it's Wally, it's your letter, February 12, investing funds in planting trees and forest lands that have been neglected for many years and currently do not have manageable stands of trees will expand the forest land base, improve salmon habitats, sequester carbon to help mitigate global climate change, increase timber supply, and create jobs in rural Oregon. There's got to be motherhood and Representative Bates.
Just one last comment. What I remember from the testimony, too, was that you're going to reforest lands at 50% private cost. And some of those will never be logged again because they'll come under the Forest Act and they'll never be logged because they'll be near streams and waterways. And so it's a significant gain for us in the long term.
Yes, for habitat. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I, let me see, anything else? We have our private folks. Do either of you want to say anything? Yeah, not, you don't have to. Just, I'm going to close. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Beck?
I guess maybe this is the time to raise the issue I've raised before, refreshment on the notion of extinguishing the sunset. Is there a rationale for that? Why not extend the sunset for 2 years, if that's what we're doing these days, or 4 years or 6 years, rather than, I mean, my concern is that now that we have a 3/5 threshold to increase taxes, we would ever take a look at this and we have a, it's easier to extend and repeal.
Who wants to respond to that?
Representative Shirley, Representative Beck. Our original intent in coming forward with the notion of eliminating the sunset basically centered on the idea of a long-term, stable funding source for the program. And since that's a different bill that's coming before you later. Sorry.
Boy. Rewind.
Representative Shirley.
Getting mixed up here, sorry.
If I may.
Please.
You have problems.
The rationale for eliminating the tax of sunset date on this particular bill is that we have so many acres out there that need to be reforested. And this program, as we've talked about earlier, has many benefits to the state.
Yeah.
And therefore, we could see not getting those acres reforested over a many-year period. If you take, if we increase it, we get 5,000 per year. If we assume that we want to eventually get half of that 1.5 million, I mean, a realistic number might be half of it. You divide 5 into 750,000, and that's the number of years that none of us will be around before we actually get those acres converted. And so it is a good program. I think most everybody agrees it's a good program, and so we just felt like, well, we just need to continue the program on.
Do I understand, Wally, that part of this is costs are incurred over a period of years? Reforestation plans, you want to provide some assurance to property owners that are going into these reforestation plans that the credit will be available for these years into the future?
Representative Shetterly, yes. It takes several years to get, if you decide you're going to convert land, you have to think about a plan in order to put this into process, because you have to do your site preparation, you have to order trees, you have to make sure the seedlings are available so you can plant the trees. And then it takes about 5 to 6 years to get these trees so that they are free to grow. And so it's a long-term plan that you have to enter into. It's something that you can't just do 1 year and then forget about it.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Staff, maybe help me understand. Repeal the sunset or terminate the sunset. If for some reason we future legislature wanted to repeal this tax credit, it would take 3/5 majority. Is that? Do I understand that right?
That's my understanding. Yes.
Okay. So I guess my... it seems like this is exactly the sort of program that is worth looking at every few years. I'm not sure every 2 years, but 6 years maybe, 10 years, well, some kind of time frame that some successive legislature can look at this, see how it's going, see if it's working. If the bar, now that we've raised the bar in the 90s to look at the tax system, it seems to me it would be, not in the public's best interest to just repeal any of these tax credit sunset dates. I think it makes a lot of sense to look at them because it's that much more difficult to adjust those programs if we want to later. We've taken so much discretion away from ourselves, this would take even more. So I guess I'd like to hear somebody talk about putting a 6-year sunset. The program can go forward, and the expectation, as you have been for the last 10 years, that the program would go forward and that you'd get your sunset renewed.
Representative Shetterly, Representative Beck, we wouldn't really object to that as long as we can continue the program and take another look at it in 6 or 7 years. We just wanted to not have to do that since it is a good program, but we wouldn't object to that.
Would you maybe object even less if the credit was raised to 50% as part of the same amendment?
Chair Shetterly, yeah, that would help.
Melody. I'm looking to the committee for guidance. This is
Mr. Chairman.
I don't have a representative.
I think Representative Beck raises a valid point here. I don't know that 6 years is right. I mean, we're talking about investments and planning that take many, many years to make. I appreciate that where he's going in terms of there probably should be some kind of a sunset, but I think it probably should be commensurate with the long-term nature of this investment. So maybe it's more like 10 years or 12 years. But I think the point's a fair one. I think some legislature down the road appropriately looks at this policy again as a matter of course and determine if it wants to continue it or not. Representative Beck, I would think maybe 10 years or 12 years might be a better duration to let this program work for people that want to use it in the meantime. Let the legislature 10 years from now or 12 years from now make the decision if they want to continue it.
We're getting a thumbs up from the private sector in the back of the room. And just trying to make everybody happy.
Well, I would mention that you have 1.5 million acres.
Oh, that's great.
I did the math. So it's 300 years. Is that a reasonable sunset for you? The original sunset was 10 years, wasn't it?
Was it 10?
The original sunset was 3 years, followed by a 4-year extension, followed by a 6-year extension, followed by a 4-year extension.
Well, if we're going to discuss this, let me program you. Once you do the reforestation, you get the credit, correct?
Correct.
So you've made the investment, and it seems like the duration of the credit doesn't affect. It doesn't affect someone who has made the investment. The sunset 3 years after they've made the investment, they've gotten the benefit to their initial reforestation. Where it would affect is people who want to keep doing it over a long period of time. So I'm not just sure I don't quite understand why a long sunset is necessary. Other than to just give people a little more confidence that the program, they can do something this year and in 8 years and then relook at it. But I'm rambling.
No. Let me suggest one way where let's say if we were to go 10, if this might be satisfactory to consider for your concerns, because there are two ways to get at this tax credit if it becomes problematic on the revenue side. Not just repealing or instituting a new sunset or repeal of it, but we have a statutory cap, and I suppose you could amend that statutory cap on the program costs if the program were getting out of hand, let's say, in terms of the revenue impact. I mean, that'd be another one. I don't think that that would require a 3/5 vote if you were to reduce the But anyway, we need to make a decision here and get on. Representative Witt, you had a...
Just a final point in response to Representative Beck's comments. This requires a significant investment, I think, on the part of landowners. So as they go and contemplate this investment, there's a certain amount of planning and financing involved in that investment. So I think we need to give sufficient time here for this act to work for enough landowners to have some value here in restoring some of these lands. It's not just a matter of going and doing it. It's a matter of planning it and having the dollars to invest into the restoring of the land. I think that, that generally calls for a longer-term sunset. So, I mean, I would... I'd support a 10-year sunset on this.
Can I see Representative Hass?
I would also support a 10-year sunset, and I'm not hung up on this moving from 30 to 50% issue. I just haven't seen, you know, why 50? Why not go to 60 or 80? I mean, I just, that rationale hasn't been laid out here. That was my only concern. Or, you know, there hasn't been one of those economic charts that say, well, at 50, then you'd lose your incentive, and you just... And it took a rip at it and said 50. So
and how they got to 30 in the first place, probably.
100% of the testimony here was to just extend this current law, which is at 30%. And I have no problem raising the percentage. I just, there's not been any rationale.
Tell you what, let's do this. I'm sensing that there is at least a majority of the committee that would be comfortable with a 10-year sunset. Let's ask for that amendment to be drafted, and that will give you folks time to develop some information, I guess, at the 50%, and then we can have this thing back. There'll be in two separate amendments. We can either go at 50 and at 10, or 30 at 10, or back to the original bill.
Mr. Chair, you don't want to do a conceptual amendment?
I don't.
It's really simple.
I think we can do conceptual amendments to on the sunset, can we?
I've done a couple.
We know. Well, we follow the rules.
We're all aware. Mr. Chairman of the conference committee.
But I thought, too, though, that the time to get those amendments would give forestry guys the time to maybe put some information together. I think you were asking for numbers, too, on the 50% and what difference that might make in utilization. I'm comfortable with that. It's not going to take long. Representative Bates?
Just a quick comment. The 50% also... You know, in 2 years, if the 50% has been successful, you can leave it alone. If it still isn't reaching the cap and you're still not getting what you want done, you can come back and discuss it again. I mean, I think you're going to have a hard time coming up with a prediction of what might or might not happen. It's going to be kind of a guesstimate.
Okay. All right, let's do that then. Oh, did you...
Chair Shirley, if I might, I know you want to leave this bill and move on, but if I could just come back to Representative Beck's question just for a moment.
Sure.
Representative Beck, the... actually, our Representative Hassett, I think, asked the question. The the Board of Forestry originally proposed in 1977 that this tax credit be 100% tax credit. And at that point in time, there were federal cost share programs that were available, and there were other programs that were available. And the board felt that the underproducing lands were just really an overwhelming issue, and they really needed to be. Now, the legislature didn't choose to do that. They chose to pass it at 10%, and then it was raised to 30% sometime later. Subsequent to that, the federal cost-share programs have really diminished, particularly here in Oregon. And these lands are very, very expensive to reforest because two reasons. First of all, because just the costs are expensive, and also there's no revenue coming off the land. And so during the time that this was instituted, the costs of maintaining are gone up. The other available programs have actually diminished, and the people that have this program, and this program doesn't work for everybody because there are landowners that don't have significant income, and for them a cost share program or something. But for those people that have income, they really, really like this program, and I'll come back with numbers to support this, but just in concept. And I also, so there's sort of a menu of things that work for people, various landowners across the landscape that work. And one of the things that is really nice about this tax credit for it is very efficient in terms of both the administration and as far as the actual, you know, getting trees in the ground through the rotation period. So there are definitely reasons, and we'll come back with numbers to back those concepts up.
All right. Very good. I appreciate the discussion. We will close the public hearing then on House Bill 2161. And we will go into a public hearing on House Bill 2677. We've had that up before, too, and that will be all. Any new witnesses today? No. Okay. Then, if there are no witnesses on House Bill 2677, anybody wish to testify, I'll close the public hearing on that, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2677.
Mr. Chair, as you recall, this bill was heard last week, and it was sponsored by Representative Merkley, and he brought a constituent in, and the argument really essentially in favor of the idea of giving taxpayer the option of requiring Department of Revenue to directly deposit their refunds into their specified account was essentially an argument of security of funds for the taxpayer. The bill that you originally saw included both personal and corporate income taxes, and we did see an amendment, although did not act on it, 2677-1, which pulled the corporate piece out of that. And so it only applies to personal, and the reason for that were cost concerns from the Department of Revenue. Deborah also spoke from the department's perspective that the proposal was consistent with the department's current policy, was actually built into their recommendations in the governor's budget. You had requested a fiscal impact statement, which was not completed at the time of the hearing last week. You now have that before you. That was kind of the missing piece. And that shows that there is a $122,000 general fund impact, but again, that's incorporated in the budget request by the Department of Revenue. You asked me to consult with the Ways and Means Committee, and they said that was part of their, while they hadn't got to that detail in terms of the co-chair's budget, they thought that was consistent with their budget policy and Ways and Means. And I know, too, that when you go out to the 2003-2005 biennium, we're saving money.
You want a motion?
Please. I think we need the Dash 1 amendments. Representative Beck?
Move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2677.
Representative Beck moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2677. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Representative Beck.
I move House Bill 2677 as amended to the floor, or Ways and Means, to the floor, with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Beck moves House Bill 2677 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that? Representative Witt.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and Paul, maybe you can help with this. This cost the Department of Revenue is going to incur were being planned anyhow this session to be able to do these sorts of refunds without issuing a paper check. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
It would be an automatic deposit, just similar to use with the payroll system oftentimes.
But these costs that we're talking about, I mean, we're being planned anyhow, even outside of this bill.
Maybe Deborah can be more specific, but my understanding is that the department was moving in that direction. This is consistent with their budget proposals for this coming biennium.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Bates?
Do we then need this bill? The next question, or is it something that was going to occur anyway?
I think the answer is we need the bill in order to actually make the refunds by direct deposit. They were anticipating, I think, this coming into play. That's my understanding from the conversation with the co-chairs. Okay, we have House Bill 2677 as amended before us. Please call the roll.
Representative
Bates. Aye.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Now.
Aye.
William.
Aye.
Witt.
Aye.
Excused?
Aye.
House Bill 2677 carries to the floor. My inclination, this is Representative Merkley's constituent bill. I'd be just inclined to let him be the carrier.
Okay.
We'll designate him. I'll let him know. Then let's go to Senate Bill 336. I'll open a public hearing. Do we have any witnesses on this? Deborah, is that you?
That's a good answer. Here's a real safety thing, too. I used to, Christmas time, I would be like, you live in jail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 336 is requested by the Department of Revenue, the Tax Administration Bill. What it does is it increases the Multi-State Tax Commission Reserve Fund authorization amount from its current level, $100,000, to $150,000. It also allows the state to enter into agreements for a collection of state debt by offsetting federal tax refunds and allows the state to pay the fees charged by the federal government for these completed offsets. And the last thing it does is it modifies the requirements for corporations to make payment of estimated tax and withholding deposits using electronic funds transfer. It also allows the department to provide exemptions to the requirement for electronic funds transfer by rule.
All right, Deborah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. A little bit of background on the first provision in the bill regarding the Multi-State Tax Commission. Oregon is a member of the Multi-State Tax Commission, and we have participated for over 30 years in joint audits that have been done by that commission. They have audit staff that performs audits for very large multi-state corporations. This is a cost efficiency for the states that are members. It's also cost efficiencies for the corporations. They don't have to deal with half a dozen different audit teams coming in from various states. Instead, they have one audit team that does the audit, and then those results are shared with the states, and the states go ahead and make adjustments. In the most recent data I have over the last 7 years, $4.2 million has been collected at a cost of less than $700,000. The reason that we're asking for the increase in the reserve account is merely because of a timing issue. Current law provides that any balance in the account on June 30th that exceeds $100,000 is to be transferred to the general fund. Just shortly after that, we're required to write a check to the Multi-State Tax Commission for audit services to be performed in the next year. And as those costs have gradually increased over the year, we're bumping up against that $100,000 limit. So it's merely a timing issue as to when the check is paid out. The second part of the bill that Ed spoke about was allowing the state to enter into a reciprocal refund offset program with the federal government. In 1998, federal legislation was passed that authorized states to participate in this. What this would allow Oregon to do is assign state tax debt to the federal government, and then that debt could be offset against a federal refund that's owed to the taxpayer. As of December 31st, there were seven states participating. They had collected over $24 million for the states, with an average offset of just over $475, and we need legislation in order to participate in that program. The final provision has to do with the requirements for corporations to make payments of estimated tax or withholding deposits using electronic funds transfer. This legislation was enacted in Oregon a few years ago to mirror federal requirements. At that time, federal was phasing in the requirements to use electronic funds transfer, and we adopted the same thresholds in Oregon law. After we adopted the thresholds, the federal government relaxed the requirements, but we have the stricter requirements in the statute, and we don't have any authority to make exceptions when it's a burden on the corporation to use electronic funds transfer. An example of that might be a multi-state corporation that has very little business activity in Oregon. They have a very minimal tax in Oregon, and yet because they're required to make payments by electronic funds transfer for federal purposes, they also have to do that for state purposes, and we can't, under the current statute, write an exception for that. So this provision would allow us to adopt rules in those cases that would exempt them from the electronic funds transfer requirement.
Okay. Well, Deborah, you cleared the room.
Thank you.
We had a crowd until you came up. Anything else? Any questions for Deborah? Representative Bates?
I don't quite understand, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't quite understand the second section. You're saying that the taxes are owed to
to the state that is then that debt is released to the federal government and they collect it for us, or they collect it out of funds they already have that they collect from the corporation, or what? I'm not quite sure what the process is there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, this would apply to a taxpayer who has a debt to the state that they haven't paid. Let's say we've assessed a liability and haven't been able to collect it. If it meets the requirements of being a certain dollar amount, we would be able to assign that debt to this federal agency, and if they had a federal tax refund, for example, that was going to be issued to that taxpayer, they would see that liability sitting there and collect the liability before remitting any balance to the taxpayer.
Okay. So it comes out of the tax refund.
The federal tax refund.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Witt.
My question is specifically to that point. Does this entering into this agreement with the federal government, does it in any way enhance the protection of the state vis-a-vis other creditors of the taxpayer that owes the dollars to the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, this applies only to state tax debt and...
I understand that. So
those are priority debts anyway.
That's what I'm trying to get at, Mr. Chairman. The question is, does this somehow give the state a greater priority in terms of getting its taxes paid than it has now relative to other debtors of the taxpayer or creditors of the taxpayer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I'm not sure about that, but I can find that out. It may, if it is offsetting that federal refund before that refund is available to other creditors to attach, then my answer would probably be yes. But
Deborah, doesn't the state, don't taxes come before general creditors anyway? I think you're already prior.
Even secured debt?
Mm-hmm.
Secured transactions in
mm-hmm.
all cases?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to guess, too, that this bill having been in the Senate committee and across the Senate floor and here, that if there was that Jim Marquis probably would have picked this up if it had represented a risk to collectors. I mean, that would have been, that'd be his big issue, I think, if this were creating some new super priority that was going to, that's just a guess on my part. He's pretty careful about this stuff. But if you, this is not the highest priority bill of the session, if you want to wait and put this off for to next week and ask the question, that's fine with me.
So maybe we could ask Mr. Marquis to come in and comment on that, yeah. Mr. Chairman.
That's fine. He says the bill is not on the fast track for me. That's true. Let's set this over to next week then, and Ed, if you could just check with Jim, and if he doesn't even want to come in, that's fine. If it's not a big issue, but let's worth.
Mr. Chairman, I think you should compel his attendance.
Okay. Would you prefer a subpoena? All right, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 336. For the record, I will close the public hearing on 2676 as well. Make sure Representative Patrick did come down, and we are adjourned.